Hello, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
I'm Giles.
And we are...
Mega City Film Club!
Film Club is back, although we've taken a slight diversion this time, and we're welcoming back Giles Richards. Hello, Giles, how are you?
Very good, Eamon. Absolute pleasure once again to join you, and especially Conrad again on the mighty Mega City Film Club. I can't do the voice.
Well, I'll say very quickly that you're the podcast's Formula One correspondent, but that's not going to be quite so important for this episode. What is important is you're earning your five-star T-shirt today. You've done three book clubs, and this is your second film club, I believe.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Yeah, five stars. Your T-shirt will be in the post.
I cannot wait to get my T-shirt, Eamon.
Right. Excellent stuff. Now, as I said before we pressed record, we've got lots to talk about today. So let's get straight to... Conrad, take us in.
There's a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination, is an area which we call Thrill One, the Twilight Zone.
Epic stuff. We are in the Twilight Zone for this episode. Giles, now obviously this is one you've picked. Give us the sort of overview of the series, The Twilight Zone, and then let's get into why it links to British comics.
Okay, thanks, Eamon. And what a spectacular introduction from Conrad there. I think Mr. Serling would be proud. We're doing The Twilight Zone. I suggested this because I grew up, obviously, I started reading 2000 AD when I was about 10, in 9 or 10 in 1979, 1980. And Future Shocks were a major part of the comic then. They still are now, much more so in those days. And it struck me that they all owed a huge debt to The Twilight Zone. And I've recently been rewatching all five seasons of The Twilight Zone on Blu-ray, which I'll say has been an absolute treat. And for anyone of my age who might have grown up with it when it was shown in the late 1970s or 60s, it's a real treat to go back to. So it was, for anyone not listening, our younger listeners, of course, it was a TV series that ran from 1959 to 1964 for five seasons. It was created by Rod Serling, who was also he wrote a lot of episodes, he produced it, and he also provided the narrated intro and outro to each show. Conrad's just read out what he opened the show with. It's a mixture of science fiction, fantasy, horror, all sorts of genres. Nothing was out of bounds for Twilight Zone. They would do, literally, Serling was happy to go with anything, largely combined with the idea of a twist ending or an unexpected ending or a moral ending or a lesson to be learned, something like that, all of which it obviously shares with Future Shocks and the various variations of Future Shocks. I'm not going to go into all the different types, but you know what I mean, the thrillers, So the connection is, well, I mean, first of all, so it's five seasons. It ran for three and was then cancelled by the network. And then the network decided they wanted to bring it back at short notice. And because they cancelled another show, commissioned the fourth season and said to Rod Serling, because we cancelled this other show, the fourth season episodes need to be an hour rather than 30 minutes, which did prove problematic. So the 30-minute episodes proved to be the perfect length, just as the Future Shocks, in and out, three, four pages, etc. Story, 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 bang, punchline. 30 minutes was perfect. Serling and the show struggled with the hour-long ones, so the fifth season it went back to the 30-minute ones, and again, and it worked very well. One of the episodes we're doing tonight, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, that was from the fifth season. So that's the basic background to the story. It has since come back in varying forms. They did a film in 1983. It was revived for TV in 1985. 2002, and most recently in 2019, in a very none of which were nowhere nearly as successful as the original series. Now, obviously, I've sort of explained why I wanted to do it, but I'll just a little bit more detail. it's impossible not to imagine that in the late 1970s and 1980s, when 2000 AD was in its creative period, being created, that the writers, that the Pat Mills, etc., all those people hadn't frankly grown up on the Twilight Zone. It had been part of, it was part at that point of British culture and American culture, obviously. But the we only had three TV channels at best at that point. There was no internet, if you can imagine that, kids. And it was on TVs in one form or the other pretty much all the time. You could pretty, turn on TV and sooner or later an episode of the Twilight Zone was going to come across. And there are obvious similarities between episodes of the Twilight Zone and what we see in Future Shock. Some are quite literally, I wouldn't like to cast aspersions, but you can see.
You can see. There's definitely some Future Shocks that are very close to specific Twilight Zone episodes. They're out there for sure.
Comrade, spot on.
I've seen them. I've seen them out there.
There are some episodes, some of which we're going to feature today, which they like so much get repeatedly referenced in Future Shocks because they think that twist is so good, we'll use it again and again and again. But so beyond 2000 AD, there's a few other things. I mean, I would say, for example, in my opinion, The 13th Floor from Scream, the horror anthology, again, completely influenced by The Twilight Zone. The idea that the end of every episode, the visitor, the bad person of the 13th floor gets a nasty and comeuppance to them is a repeated feature of the Twilight Zone. In fact, it's considered part of this idea of the Twilight Zone's morality, in that, if you're bad in the Twilight Zone, you're likely to come to a sticky end. And the 13th floor is effectively based on that. We also see it in the morality tales of Misty magazine, where again, I mean, not so much as a horror genre, but where characters who are immediately portrayed as being bad and deserve a bit of being dealt with, get dealt with. And again, I can't help but think this entire period is influenced by the Twilight Zone, and we also see it when in Des Skin did one-off horror stories in the Hammer Horror magazine, which were forerunners of the same formula, a one-off short run and done horror story with a punchline at the end, which again majorly influenced by the Twilight Zone, the more macabre episodes and horror-based episodes of the Twilight Zone. And because the Twilight Zone ran for so long, it's 156 episodes, they're covering every genre. So as I hear, the genres I listed there, sci-fi, horror, girls, what we once called girls comics, etc., they're all there to influence their influence from the Twilight Zone. And I don't think anyone should be ashamed of that. It's enormously great. I would say absolutely great television. And I mean, it may look a little bit dated now, but I still think it's a work of genius.
Now, Conrad, you have become a sort of scholar of British comics of the late 70s and the early 80s. We've mentioned it already, but you must have seen the connections in all the various Terror Tales, Time Twisters, Future Shocks, and the other comics that you've covered as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, over on Space Spinner, and if you aren't familiar with the show, I can't assume everyone that listens to Mega City Book Club also listens to Space Spinner, I guess. There certainly is overlap. But very much, we've covered 2000 AD, from the start to the mid-90s. And so much of Future Shocks is that, waiting for the punchline, waiting for, like, the thing. We always have air horns in Space Spinner to sort of be like, oh, no, look at that. And it's very similar when we get to that in, especially the episodes we're looking at today for the Twilight Zone. I think there are some Twilight Zones that don't have, where the twist isn't the big thing in them. We got some twisty ones today. And so much of that narrative is just inherent to the Twilight Zone. I think it's something that the Twilight Zone really innovated, but that then is such a natural fit for something like 2000 AD or other comic books. I mean, just the, like Giles said, with the having them be like three or four pages, that naturally makes a twist very easy because you can have two pages on the comic, and then, you know, on the third page that you have to turn over, then there's the twist, you know, or something like that. I think it's a really, like, it really suits the comics medium, and especially in British comics, these sort of like the quick, you know, we've got a couple pages to fill and get out there, specifically like for that medium, they work really well.
Fantastic. Well, we have decided to cover 5 episodes of The Twilight Zone. We've each picked an episode or two to talk about, which give us an example of the sort of thing we've been talking about. Now, the 5 episodes, I'll give people spoilers. These are 5 episodes that are often picked in top 10 lists of Twilight Zone episodes. So they're very well known. I'd say that the twists are probably amongst the best known in Twilight Zone history, but we will give a spoiler warning, and the listing of the episode will be in the show notes. So if you don't want to be spoiled, have a look at the episodes we're going to cover. I'll also just give another little content warning to say that Conrad's air horns are coming up shortly. Brace yourself. Space Spinner air horns have been imported into the Megacity Film Club for this one-off episode.
I will say also, just like in terms of spoilers, like generally, like, if you like participate in Western culture, like you're familiar with the spoilers for these episodes.
Yes.
You know, I think every single one of the ones we're looking at least half of them have like been specifically been parodied like on The Simpsons or something. Most of them you've seen references to in other things and stuff like that. For, you know, I watched this with my brother, actually, and we had a rollicking good time when we got to the twist, just like, oh, like this happened, you know, like, and that I think is the way to watch The Twilight Zone now. Although I will say the twists are fun, but also I'll say that like the craft of these episodes, despite it being like 1959 or something, is also amazing. Some of these episodes are really well shot and really cool. We'll talk about that more as we get to it.
Okay, well, let's get started. We'll go with our first one, Conrad.
Twilight Zone 1, time enough at last.
This is a season 1, episode 8 episode written by Rod Serling himself from a short story by Lynn Venable, directed by John Brahm, and starring Burgess Meredith. Giles, over to you for the synopsis and the twist.
Okay, thanks, Eamon. Air horns coming. Can't wait. The to add on to what Eamon and Conrad said, frankly, if you'd have to be living under a rock to not have noticed the twists in these ones. But we also did specifically choose them because they were very future shock type twists. Mm-hmm. They were the most future shocky of all. So I will, you know, there's 156 episodes. There are other better episodes than these. There are worse episodes than these. There's all sorts. But, you know, if you're wondering about our choices, that's what we were going for. Literally all 3 of us running down the street blaring air horns. future shot written on the side of the air horns. Anyway, okay, so Time Enough at Last has a Burgess Meredith in his who was a Twilight Zone stalwart. I think he was in at least 4 episodes before everyone knew him from being in Rocky. So anyway, he plays Henry Bemis, who is a put upon bank clerk, very much put upon by a bullying wife, who fits into one of the 2 Twilight Zone sort of women stereotypes, which again dates the show a little bit, in that women are largely either terrible, terrible bullying harpies or rather simpering background figures. Which doesn't do the show great favors, but it was 1959. So he's put upon by his wife. He's bullied by his bank manager. And just to give the show a little bit of context for Henry, is he wears enormously thick, what we used to call Coke bottle glasses. So the glass in the glasses is like the thickness of the base of a Coke bottle. And there are also those ones such that when the camera is facing at him, his eyes appear enormous. And this is to stress how poor his eyesight is, just to hammer that home. But, I mean, the other interesting thing about this episode is that the first half of it, at least, where Bemis is bullied, all he wants to do is read. which seems to be a pretty reasonable enough thing. So he's reading when he's at work. He's trying to read it when he's at home. But his wife takes real exception to him reading, to the extent that she finds a book of his poetry and scribbles out all the words in the book of poetry and then tears the page. I mean, she's got a real thing about
it. She won't be married to a reader, Giles. She simply won't.
and the bank manager berates him by calling him a reader, as a term.
Shocking.
Yeah. So he's having a terrible old time with it, Henry Bemis. And this is another one of these things I think works with Future Shocks, is this first half of the show where it's Henry being bullied, all he wants to do is read, no one will let him read. It has almost a sitcom-y theme to it, air to it. It has that light sitcom music. You know, it feels like it's going to be a comedy episode because it's almost farcical. And that's done deliberately, I believe, you know, in order to make the transition that the show turns into all the more hard-hitting, which a good Future Shock will do as well. So inevitably, Henry is exasperated by his inability to read. So he does what all of us would do, which is take his lunch down to the vault of the bank vault and locks himself in order that he can eat his lunch and read in peace, which obviously we've all thought of doing. When he's down there, he's got a newspaper with him. He's got a newspaper with him, and the headline of the newspaper reads "H-bomb capable of complete destruction" in huge letters. And if anyone's watching, you should also look out for the subhead on that page, which is "Building Code Under Fire," which is the
second classic.
Yeah, the headline down the left, and you will see that headline on almost every Twilight Zone episode where someone's reading the newspaper. They're getting the Building Code Under Fire one in there, but the one we're interested in is in 72-point black caps across the top. H-bomb. Shortly after he's reading it, the bank vault shakes and shudders. There's a huge crash, etc. Henry's knocked out. He comes to, he emerges, and the H-bomb has indeed destroyed everything. He climbs out of the vault. You know, everything's destroyed. Everyone is dead. Everything is destroyed. It's well done, this. The destruction is well done. It's not, you know, they've got a good destroyed cityscape built outside the bank. It's quite apocalyptic, frankly, but for Henry's purposes, everyone is dead. He discovers he's got enough food to live on. There is, fortunately, of course, the elephant in the room, no radiation at this point. But again, it being the 1950s, we weren't too worried about that. So, but Henry begins to be quite upset because it turns out he's quite lonely now. He doesn't know what he's going to do with all his time, and he begins to consider suicide. He finds a gun and he's thinking, well, I don't know why I should go on. And just when he reaches his lowest ebb, he looks up and spots that across the road, the public library is there. And while it has been destroyed, many, many, many of the books have survived and have spilled out onto the street. In fact, there are hundreds of books, and Henry gleefully climbs the steps and starts piling the books up. He can't believe it. There's no people left, but he's got all these books and he piles them. He's going, here's January, here's February, here's next year. And he's absolutely ecstatic. And as an audience, we're thinking, well, crikey, you know, this is a pretty grim old episode, but it's all worked out for Henry, hasn't it? And Henry reaches down to pick up one final book. And then as he leans over, his glasses fall off his face, fall to the ground and smash into pieces.
Oh no!
and the show. I mean, I mistimed that slightly, but that's what happens. But before he delivered the perfect payoff line, before that, he sits amongst his books, ecstatically says, "Time enough at last," in order to do his reading, and then the glasses fall, and it goes to pieces. Fantastic, ironic twist that we see in so many Future Shocks in forms of other, you know, it's not a sort of retribution type twist because we quite like Henry. He really didn't deserve it. So this is just one of those, it's awfully, terribly sad. And Rod Serling appears to give his end show narration, at which he now says, Henry Bemis, now a piece of the rubble.
Conrad, this is a classic twist, as we say. Everybody sort of knows what's coming in a way, but that doesn't take from the enjoyment of the episode. And also, how many Future Shocks featured the end of the world and characters emerging into the rubble.
I think it is something that reflects anxieties of the time, you know, and just the idea of, you know, a nuclear war apocalypse being like around the corner at any given minute being something that people were, you know, is enough of something to worry about that it could just sort of be a part of the landscape if you're sort of telling a story like this, you know, that I think is interesting. Like, I think, you know, the earlier version of this would have to be like, you'd have to go full Rip Van Winkle or something for this sort of a similar sort of situation or something, as opposed to just, yep, there's a nuke, so we're all dead. Like, that's just how it goes.
And in the pages of 2000 AD, we've certainly seen that sort of survivor emerging into the rubble of the devastation after a nuclear bomb has gone off, usually with a punchline about the person that they meet and their name or something like that. That one was was frequently done, wasn't it, Giles?
Yeah. I mean, it's countless the number of times where, you know, the setup is meet the characters, bomb falls, turn the page, here's the punchline. Yeah, I mean, it could be the irony of why it had happened or who they'd meet or in fact where they were. Was it really a bomb, etc. Their permutations are countless. I mean, you know, it was always there. I think there's also that thing of having of just the sheer brutal irony of it all, that you've spent the entire time getting to that point, so you impose this terrible, terrible, harsh irony on your lead character, which is, you know, a great trope of a good twist.
And a lead character played by Burgess Meredith, as you say, who cropped up in several Twilight Zones. But we're going to mention another sort of very famous name coming up at the end of our five episodes. But here, you know, Burgess Meredith, he's fantastic, isn't he? We just like him.
Yeah, I really like... When we watch this, we really love just how henpecked Henry is and just how wanting to, like, it's not like he's reading like junk. He's reading like, you know, Charles Dickens and like, you know, fancy poetry and stuff like that. Like, he's reading classy stuff, for the record. Like, he's not actually reading like 2000 AD or something similar of the time. It's just everybody's so... cartoonishly anti-reading that is really makes it really funny and like a fun story as well, just because you know I think, especially if you are kind, maybe you have less of a choice, obviously, if it's 1959 and there's only, you know, three channels in England, or four, you know, similarly three in like America. But, you know, if you're watching kind of a sci-fi show, like you know, I feel like the people who are watching The Twilight Zone are probably also reading a little bit at least, or can at least empathize with wanting to do something and your wife yells at you about it or something, or so, you know, your boss or something like that. And so we definitely empathize immediately with Henry and just how put upon he is by everyone in his life about this stuff. And so we can, and then similarly, the idea of like, oh yeah, like, you know, what if I just had a chance to just do what I wanted to do and there was no restrictions on it and stuff, that would be so fun, so freeing, so amazing. But then, but I lose it all, you know, it brings you down and then up and then down again. Ah, geez.
It's almost like the Twilight Zone he inhabits is one where reading or being, as you say, right, a reader is the discriminated against, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's in its way, it's a bizarre concept. As Conrad said, it's not like he's sat on the toilet reading the funny pages or something. He's, you know, he is reading. He wants to read books.
He wants to read the classics. Yeah,
and he's terribly enthusiastic about it. He, you know, so yeah, it's. It's an awful. He gets an awful deal out of the whole affair, frankly.
Oh dear. Well, let's leave poor Henry Beamish with his broken glasses in the rubble of a nuclear holocaust, with time enough at last, and let's move on to Conrad.
Twilight Zone 2: Eye of the Beholder.
We're in season 2, episode 6, again written by Rod Serling, directed by Douglas Hayes. Conrad, this is one of your picks.
Absolutely. It's about a woman in a hospital. Her head's covered in bandages. She's on the 11th surgery to try to correct her horrible, disfigured, ugly visage. We hear all the nurses and doctors sort of talking amongst themselves like, oh, have you seen the lady in there? Oh, she's gross, like whatever. And eventually we get through. They cut the bandages off her face. And shock horror, what's under there? Oh my God, she's actually a pretty girl, but everybody else is a gross pig person. Ah! They got weird pig noses and asymmetrical lips, and it's a real fun like practical effect just on these dudes as they kind of walk around looking all gross and then acting all horrified as they see. What's her name? I think it's, Donna Douglas.
Donna would Douglas later be the face, isn't she?
Yeah, she'd be Ellie Mae Clamp, Ellie Mae from the Beverly Hillbillies later and stuff. And eventually she runs through the hospital all gross and ugly, I guess, and meets with another dude who's similarly just grossly disfigured, Edson Stroll, who's like this sort of like, you know, classic like hunk of dude, and says, oh yeah, we can, since it's the last time trying this procedure and your ugliness is incurable, you can go live in the Uggo colony with me. And, you know, there's an old saying that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So maybe we can live our ugly lives together, when despite the fact that, of course, they're actually both pretty hot and everybody else is a gross pig person. Good times.
So two effects to talk about in the construction of this episode. Let's start. I'll ask you, Giles. First of all, of course, they have to go to considerable sort of technical artifice to not reveal anybody's faces until we get the bandages off. And watching it when you know the twist, it's sort of like intriguing as to how they did that, isn't it?
I really like this. That, yeah, for sure. Go ahead. Sorry,
it's fine. I mean, well, first of all, I imagine it was Otto Sump block they went to when they finally taken out of circulation. She's also extraordinarily beautiful. The actress whose name I can't remember.
Donna Douglas.
Obviously. Yeah, no, I it's really interesting this, because when you know the twist, you look for the way they filmed it. You look for the how are they not showing the pig face, etc. But I think that when you first, if you watch it without knowing that, I actually think the artifice is very skillful. I mean, really, really well done. It's not clunky. I don't think it's noticeable if you're not looking for it in that way. You just, you know, people's backs are to camera, or their faces are unlit or in the shade part, or they're looking out of a window. Yeah. There are two nurses have an entire conversation. Well, on at least one occasion, they exchange a pack of cigarettes, etc., and it looks completely normal. But during that period, you see neither of their faces.
It just makes it feel like moody and like dark and stuff like that. Yeah. And like tense and stuff. Cause people are like, I think they're having fun with it. Cause cause you see all these people through just their silhouettes through a screen or something like that, you know, or like, I think there's a big brother type political leader who you see, but like, it's very like zoomed out. So you can just sort of get a sense of him on like a big video screen. You can't actually like see his face or anything like that. I love the camera work in this episode. Actually, I think it's really fun.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually, because when I watched this episode, I'd forgotten there's the sort of television footage, news footage covering a political rally, that this Twilight Zone, they live in a sort of weird fascist dystopia, and anybody is very specific. Anybody who does not conform to the norm is excluded from society. There's a strange weirdness to that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, this is an interesting thing about the Twilight Zone, and specifically in this and many other episodes, is that Rod Serling was what I believe now would be called a progressive liberal.
Yes.
He was very strong on social issues and on racial equality. He felt very strongly about all these things. He fought as a paratrooper in World War II, and he did bring these issues into the episodes as much as he could, genuinely sneaking them past the network, who weren't keen. The network wanted him to make fancy shows and flog fags. That was what they were interested in. But Serling, did bring a lot of these issues up. He addressed fascism on more than repeated occasions. And this is definitely part of this episode. It's not the central part. The central part is everyone's pig men, right?
the
chief pig man is a Nazi. And his thing is that everyone has to conform. And if you're not completely conforming by looking the same as us by the time you've had your 11th operation, then it's off to Argo Town for you. So, he's making a point about here. He's making a point about conformity and oppression, while part of this, again, I think the suits at the network will be going, oh, it's a nice fantasy show. And it turns out everyone's big people, but Serling very cleverly snuck in a commentary about fascism and about oppression and conformity here.
So that's brilliantly done. The camera work, as you say, and the filming of the episode is brilliantly done. And then we get the scene when the bandages come off. We see Donna Douglas's beautiful face, and then we get the reveal as she runs through the hospital corridors of the pig people. Conrad, what do you make of the special effects and the makeup of the pig design?
I think it's great. They really make them disturbing. And I think that's one that's really stuck with me. Just whenever he's got these big lips that kind of hang out and are not symmetrical, which I think is really makes them extra ugly. I think, and they got these upturned noses and all this stuff, but I love that they've clearly they've got at least five of these masks that they've put on just a whole bunch of different extras and stuff like that, I really like that, because we mentioned, Giles mentioned, there are a bunch of parts where you see them messing around with cigarettes and stuff. So they're clear to show how, someone's with a cigarette dangling out of the weird sideways lips and stuff. But yeah, I think it's really fun. And they do a lot. And just as the lady's running through the hospital, we see all these random folks, you see a doctor and a nurse having an intimate moment and stuff like that. Also, just generally just making it be you wouldn't know if this was your life, then you just be a pig person and it'd be fine. You don't notice it. And then there's this weird person that doesn't have an upturned nose and has tiny, tiny lips. And that's gross. It's weird.
It's all amazingly done. The makeup's great. The camera work leading up to the reveal is great. And as you say, Giles, the way that Rod Serling sort of snuck in his message about fascist societies and the need for conformity is fantastic. It's probably, and also possibly, one of the most memorable visuals from these episodes, particularly these episodes we've been looking at of The Twilight Zone.
If you haven't, again, I think you're in trouble if you aren't aware of the Pig People episode of The Twilight Zone. It got referenced in Seinfeld, as I recall, when Kramer becomes absolutely convinced that there is a pig person in a hospital they're visiting. And he spends the entire episode chasing around the hospital trying to catch the pig person. Now, decades later, it was being referenced.
There was also a really funny Saturday Night Live sketch that was basically this episode, but they cut the bandages off and it's Pamela Anderson underneath, and then one of the pig people is like, whoa, she's hot. that's wild. And so the other people are like, what? No, come on. She doesn't look anything like us. I know what hot is. And she's hot. No, but don't you understand? In our society, this is normal. Whatever, pig lady. That's a hot chick. And that was pretty funny as well. So just again, I guess showing some of the ubiquity of these Twilight Zones, where you can sort of just take this episode as read and then sort of make jokes about it, sort of from there, I guess.
And I feel it's a very future shock thing to have the main character's face concealed until the very last frame, the last panel. And then there'd be some sort of reveal of what they look like.
I mean, if it's a future shock, this one's way easier. Like, you don't even, like, you know, you don't even notice. You can just focus on the head in each panel or something, you know, on the bandaged head and stuff like that. You would barely even notice that you weren't showing other people's faces if you just do it, you know, if you're doing it in comics form, you know.
And it's nicely, as you say, it's perfectly set up such that the reveal is the last panel, you know.
Yeah.
That's Future Shock 101. There we go, you know. And if you only had two pages to play with, you can still do it.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, I mean, because, like, you know, this one could definitely be like 5 minutes long, you know, or something like that. Like, you could end it right when they cut the bandages off and that, you know, just get the pig people reveal and that's the episode. But sort of, it's got to be 30, so you have extra stuff as well, you know.
Okay, well, that's our second one. We're going to turn to the next one, which is, I'm going to say in advance, this is a Future Shock trope that has been revisited a few times. Conrad, take us to
Twilight Zone 3, The Invaders.
We're still in series 2, episode 15. This is written by sci-fi legend Richard Matheson, directed by Douglas Hayes. Giles, what are your picks?
The Invaders. So I think this is a brilliant episode. I'll be briefer this time, if I may. But and basically, we open on a isolated farmhouse. In the isolated farmhouse is a woman played by Agnes Moorehead, who is effectively the only character in this, or the only actor in this piece, and she's brilliant. I might add, she's to all intents and purposes human. She's going about her farmhouse business, chopping vegetables, what have you. Here's a spaceship landing. Spaceship lands on her roof. It's not very big. It comes up to about her knees when she investigates it. Two small alien invaders come out of the spaceship and proceed to terrorize her. They're in their little spacesuits, which are a little bit like silver-colored Michelin men. And they shoot ray guns at her, and she fights them off with a giant wooden spoon. And it's all, and you know, and when they shoot ray guns at her, she gets heat welts on her body. It's all, you know. Quite when she's having a terrible old time of it, and this goes. She doesn't speak the entire period, and the tiny little invaders, they pick up a kitchen knife and stab her with it. You know, it's quite brutal, in fact. Although they are tiny invaders, and eventually she's driven to distraction by this entire affair, climbs back onto the roof with a hatchet, smashes the spaceship that they've come in, which is a flying saucer, smashes the spaceship which they've come in after. By the way, having killed one of them by putting it in a sack, then putting it in a box and burning it to death on the fire, which was good work there. Smashes it to pieces. In the process of smashing to pieces, the last remaining alien invader is on the radio to his home base, saying, revealing that, don't come after us. We can't come to this planet. It's inhabited by a race of brutal giants, the alien says. And then the radio is cut off as the woman smashes the spaceship to pieces. And as she sort of slumps against the wall, the camera pans round to show writing on the side of the spaceship, which says, US Air Force Space Probe Number 1.
So my gosh.
This is the ultimate top-end, full-end Future Shock. It's a Future Shock air horn double whammy in the the double whammy, which is that first, the aliens were in fact human size, but the woman was a giant. So it's an error of scale. And also it turns out we were the aliens. Both of which the Future Shocks would milk until they were dry.
Absolutely.
And brilliantly constructed episode, because you've mentioned that Agnes Moorehead gives this solo performance where she does not have speak, obviously. We just get grunts and sort of groans from her. It's very, again, when you know the twist, the artifice or the way they've constructed of it is extremely well done, isn't it, Giles?
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, again, her performance is very good, and there, until you know the twist, there is no sense. You assume that she is an Earth woman, and that we are on Earth, and that the invaders are tiny invaders, etc. But in order not to give in that way, she doesn't speak. There's no exposition. You don't hear her thinking, "Crikey, I don't like these invaders," or anything like that, or any thought processes or anything like that. She's just going about her business and reacting to it. So that when you do finally reach the denouement, and you discover that in fact it's us and we're tiny, and it's also it's us, we're the invaders. It's a proper shock. You know, it's a proper, you weren't expecting it. They came down in a flying saucer. You know, that's where the aliens come from. It's not where we come from. Brilliantly constructed. I mean, very, very well made. You can quibble a little bit, as you can quibble with almost any of these things, that the invaders themselves don't look enormously good in their little space suits, etc. But you know, they're doing their best with quite literal practical effects in 1959. I mean, that was in the case of this, that's some guy with his fingers in a miniature space suit, operating the legs and the arms with his fingers. So I think it's brilliantly constructed they should be paying, Future Shock should be paying royalties to this episode.
Conrad, because on Space Spinner 2000, you may have covered errors of scale Future Shocks from time to time. Is that right?
Indeed. I mean, like Giles said, like this is, you know, very much like, oh, they're tiny, or oh, they're big, actually, is such a key, you know, I mean, because again, like talking about the page, like, you know, very classic Future Shock is to have one page of just, look at these aliens, they're so cool, let's get a guy to draw some cool, you know, to draw some neat looking alien stuff. And then you turn the page over and the flying saucer is the size of a frisbee and it gets eaten by a dog. This is obvious. This is clear, easy stuff to do. And very much, very easy, and makes for a very fun Twilight Zone episode, and a very easy layout. Like, sort of, you know, we don't have enough ads. We need to fill two pages of this comic. Like, all right, like, let's just do this. You know, it's fine. You know, I think it's kind of definitely, I know, like, I was watching this with my brother who hadn't seen this episode before, actually. I hadn't seen this one in a while, and like, I was sort of, I said, I noticed she isn't talking, because I was sort of like on the hunt for the twist and stuff. But I think it's also like, as much as you can mention that that's something that stands out, for the record, if you were home alone and suddenly there were a bunch of tiny aliens bumping around, you probably wouldn't talk. You know, like, you don't, it's a very TV thing to imagine someone narrating what they're doing, to say like, oh, I'm scared of these aliens, I'd better find a way to fight them. You wouldn't do that in real life. You just sort of do, you know, you'd be like this, like you'd maybe shout if, like, you know, one of them, if you tried to open a door and then they home alone you by putting a knife through the keyhole or whatever, like in the show. But, you know, you wouldn't be narrating everything, the way that we'd sort of expect a TV character to, I guess.
I thought this was a brilliant episode, which I hadn't actually seen before I watched it for this film club. This is absolutely fantastic stuff, particularly by Agnes Moorehead, but also by the direction of it. If regular listeners will know that when I did Jeff Hawke with Richard Chief, that also contained miniature aliens invading Earth in that one. And I asked about when this sort of error of scale trope may have started. And somebody pointed me at possibly Gulliver's Travels being, you know, like the first one in English literature. So if you know better examples, let me know. I also just thought that at the end of the first Men in Black film, we get that sort of pull out, pull out, pull out, where it's revealed that the Earth is a marble in an alien's pouch of marbles, which I think also we've seen in Future Shocks possibly as well. I've got a feeling Alan Moore's done that one.
Yeah, this is, you know, yeah, a lot of like all this contained within something, like, you know, a universe in a ball, I think of like everything being like, you know, just one computer simulation of many or something like that, that sort of thing. Like everything's on this computer or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
If you pull back enough, it becomes small again, that kind of thing.
The Hitchhiker's Guide did the same thing.
Yeah.
With the two vast alien war fleets who turn up to exact revenge on Earth and are swallowed by a small dog. I did a bit of research on this, and the first one I could find in the actual prog was prog 27, which is the third ever Future Shock. I'm sure Conrad will remember this. I don't remember it, but the third ever Future Shock called First Contact, where a spaceship lands in what appears to be a forest, and it's all that, and the Earth people are saying, well, where's it landed? We can't find it. We can't find it. And you turn the page. It turns out the forest it's landed in is, in fact, just grass, because the spaceship's tiny. And then one of the scientists who's been sent to look for it stands on it and squashes it.
Prog 27.
Every time, you know.
This one was terrific. And as yes, you know, it is one that 2000 AD and other British comics have returned to a few times as a source of inspiration. Yeah, so that is season 2, episode 15, The Invaders by Richard Matheson. Give it a watch. It's pretty good. Okay, we're on to
Twilight Zone 4, To Serve Man.
We jump to season 3, episode 24. This is back written by Rod Serling from a story by Damon Knight, directed by Richard L. Baer. Over to you, Conrad. Tell us about this one. One of your picks.
Absolutely. You know, classic one, I think. We're at the UN. Oh, man, aliens have landed. They're Canamite aliens, they're called. They're 9 feet tall. They got big old foreheads. They talk telepathically. And one of them's got a big old book. And reading from it, he says, we're going to help humanity do all kinds of stuff. We're going to give you new energy sources, cure all those diseases, end famine, all this kind of stuff. It's a great utopia. These aliens are cool dudes. And hey, they're offering a chance for us to come live on their planet. And that sounds pretty cool. Like, if they helped our planet become so nice, surely their planet's awesome. Let's go check it out. Meanwhile, there's this guy who's like a code breaker, and he's, you know, listen, like the one of the aliens left his book behind. So like, let's see what it says. It sounds like that could be a fun for a laugh, right? Anyway, first they managed to decode just the cover of the book, and it said, and the name of the book is To Serve Man. And they're like, oh, well, they're here to serve us. They're here to help us out. That's awesome. The codebreaker guy accepts an offer to go live on the alien planet. He's about to get on the spaceship when his assistant, who's a lovely lady, she has been continuing to decode the book in her spare time, and Jesse gets on the saucer. She comes running up and screams, I decoded the book and it's a cookbook.
Oh my goodness. Oh no. Giles, did you enjoy this episode?
I love this episode, Eamon. What's interesting about this is, for your listeners who are listening but not viewing, is that all three of us are grinning like monkeys and while we're describing it.
It's fun.
It is total fun. They are, you know, these are fun episodes. They're enjoyable. So, yeah, I loved this. I loved it from start to finish. Again, I mean, what are you going to do? Once you know it's a cookbook, the entire thing is sort of redundant. You know, there's a lot of stock footage being used in the first 10 minutes of New York and of the UN and of all this sort of thing. And once you know it's a cookbook, all of that is sort of irrelevant. There's a great Russian ambassador at the UN, for example, who in one scene is seen just stuffing his face with a sandwich or something like that, I'm sure, which is just to give the uncivilized Russian look, etc. There's all sorts of lovely things going on. There's Richard Kiel as the alien.
Yes, young Richard Kiel from the 1970s Bond movies.
Yeah, Jaws.
Jaws himself, yes.
So all sorts of things. It's very well done. It's a great episode. It's quite rightly, as Conrad mentioned at the start, you know, this has been parodied and referenced so many times, it's off the scale. I mean, I think The Simpsons have done it more than once. And rightly so, it's a classic in that sense. My thing with this is it's interesting this, because I think it should have ended when the lady codebreaker comes on and shouts, it's a cookbook. When it was originally shot, that was the ending. She was going to shout it, and there was going to be a sort of big alien hand come down and drag the bloke onto the ship. But there was a lot of post-production issues, and Rod didn't think it was quite where he wanted it to be. So they did some reshoots and it just went on a little bit longer at the end with the central character narrating, talking about when he knows his fate on the spaceship. So, but I mean, apart from that, which is a taste thing, I guess, you know, I think it would have been better ending on the air horn there. But no, otherwise, it's a great episode.
I think I saw The Simpsons parody, or one of The Simpsons parodies of this, long before I saw the episode itself. And it's a little bit like if you see Conrad might not know this one, but if you see the French and Saunders parody of The Exorcist and then you watch the original movie in that order, it's sort of the parody sort of detracts from it slightly and takes away from the purity of the original. The Simpsons have done this one on Treehouse of Horror a few times, I think, Conrad.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it's a class. It's one of the first ones, and like, you know, Kang and Kodos, the alien, these are squid alien kind of guys, and they've got a book, and it says to serve man, and then I think Lisa's like, look at this. It's a cookbook, and they're like, yeah, it's a cookbook for humans because there's some dust on the cover, and it says to serve man, but it says like for dinner. It says and there's a third joke, like, no, it's to serve 40 men or how to cook for 40 men for dinner or something like that. This one is like one of the classic like Twilight Zones, I think, and that's sort of like it's a cookbook is such a like. It's a hilarious twist, I think, and just a funny one. I think low-key, when I was thinking about this one, I thought it was actually kind of messed up that Richard Keeler or whatever is doing his big address to humanity, saying that they're going to help us and stuff while holding a cookbook for humans. That's very much telling a bunch of cows how you're going to make the field better while holding a like 50 burger recipes book or something like that. Like, why would you bring it, you know? Are you that hungry?
He leaves it in the UN as well.
You're just standing in the UN with a recipe book for how you're going to eat the people that are in there. Like, these aliens are wild people, you know? It's just mean or something. You know, it's a weird thing to do. But generally, though, obviously, once you know the twist, you're just looking for the twist, I think. And that's what a lot of these twist, any twist episode or thing, even like the Sixth Sense or something where you kind of like where the whole thing's built around a twist, especially on a second view, or if you know the twist ahead of time, then you're watching and looking for that. Right. And I think that this does an admirable job of playing it fairly straight and just sort of like they don't do too much. I think you could really lean into this by having the Canamites doing a lot of like, we wish only to serve you, or, you know, eat and grow around or something. You know, they can make a lot more references to the fact that they're here to eat people and they don't. And I think that helps it be like not too dumb, basically.
And Giles, in 2000 AD, we've had a variety of misinterpreted alien visitations on Earth in various future shocks. I'm thinking of the Alan Moore one about the Grawks bearing gifts. There's also the one about the translator machine is it the travel guide, I think, that, you know, about various aliens eating people. It's been, you know, again, this sort of theme has been taken and run with, hasn't it?
Yeah, you can go variations on this theme again are almost endless. Once you identify similar with the invaders, the errors of scale, it's we with the invaders, whatever. You can go almost anywhere you like with this. And I also just point out in Rod's closing narration, one of the lines he says is the cycle of man from dust to dessert, which it's pleased me immensely.
Pretty good.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, the invaders are here. The first couple of pages is they're here for X purpose. Turns out, final two panels, the purpose is nefarious, or it's specifically almost the exact opposite of what we've been expecting. Variations on that. Pretty easy to do, I think. I think as well, and you know, the what's great about this is that the cookbook thing and the play on to serve man part of it is a clever conceit, but it's not. But you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be that clever with it in comic book form. If you're repeating it, you just give it another turn, and you know, I mean, I'm thinking of the. You could make a case, for example, that the aliens in the series V, the first half of the series V is this episode.
Yes,
we're going to bring you lots of stuff, and we're perfectly normal, and we don't want anything from you. Turns out they're lizards that eat rodents.
Yeah,
that's not humans.
And I think that like you know, there's a lot of anxiety about sort of like, you know, benevolent outside, like I think, you know, of benevolent, seemingly benevolent outsiders coming to help us, but actually having, you know, nefarious goals in mind and stuff like that. I think that's sort of a pretty common thing. I think also like, even just like the misinterpreting things, I think you see that in a lot. I think there's other Twilight Zones like this specifically, but like in a lot of like, I don't know, like genie stories or something, the idea that, you know, you see something that seems to plainly mean one thing, but it actually means something else and stuff, that sort of wordplay, you know, to serve man for, you know, but actually to serve man for dinner, or like, you know, I want to live forever, but you get turned into a statue, like that kind of thing, you know, like are, you know, easy fodder for these kinds of twist endings and stories and things like that.
Okay, so yeah, it's terrific fun. And yes, young Richard Keel as the Canamite alien, or one of them, yeah.
Poor on that one, Eamon. Poor old Richard doesn't get his voice used.
No, because they speak telepathically, yes.
Yeah, so it's another actor doing the voice. So unfortunately, he has to do this thing where he's required to act by sort of just staring quizzically into the middle distance while, as Conrad says, holding his giant cookbook.
It's wild stuff.
It really is. I mean, that is top-end TV.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you in a moment about the legacy of the show and perhaps some of the sequels and spin-offs. But before we do that, we've got one more visit to
Twilight Zone 5, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
So this is my pick, Season 5, Episode 3, by Richard I Am Legend Matheson and directed by Richard Donner, Superman director himself. I can't believe anybody does not know the story of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, but just very briefly, a young William Shatner is a very nervous passenger on a plane. He's recovering from, shall we say, a nervous breakdown. He's very nervous about flying, and his flight becomes much, much worse because there's something on their wing. A classic Twilight Zone, one that they like so much that they used it in the 1983 movie as well. Giles, this is another banger, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a classic. We're picking classics. We're picking them because they've got a great story, and also they're the ones everyone known. The Gremlins on the wing. Shatner is brilliant in this. This is, as Conrad referred to him earlier, this is baby Shatner, the Shatette, before he turned into a before his thing became that whole sort of scenery chewing Kirk Shatner. So he's actually really understated in this, which is really good because it works really well. You know, he has to be believable as a man who's previously suffered a mental breakdown about a year ago while on an aeroplane, and now he's back on an aeroplane having been in recovery from his mental breakdown, and that's when he starts seeing things on the wing. He starts seeing the gremlin on the wing, which is, unfortunately for the episode, it's a man in a bear suit, and it's not a great-looking bear suit either. You know, if you look, it's not a great outfit. It works particularly well when there's a close-up of the gremlin up against the window when Shatner pulls the curtain aside and it's got his face pressed up against it. That's very, very good. But when he's generally bouncing about on the wing itself, in amongst the trying to pull the wires out, etc., it looks like a dude in a bear suit. There's no doubt about that. And interestingly enough, they filmed all this because of all the water, because they were spraying water about, because it was supposed to be raining. They filmed it about 40 feet in the air above a big water tank, so it was quite dangerous for the dude in the bear suit as well. And also they attempted to waterproof the bear suit, but it didn't really work very well, so that it became sodden and heavy almost within minutes of him putting it on and being drenched with water. So it was a tricky job as well for it to be done. But you know, for all those failings, even William Shatner years later said, you know, he gently mocked how, you know, it's like, well, you know, I was acting and there was this guy. Did you see it? You could see the seams on that suit. You know. He said it still worked brilliantly, and he's absolutely right. It still does. You know, in a way, I like the fact that it you know, if it was done now, it would be extremely complex and brilliant in CGI. I quite like that it's not. And that's again part of the appeal of these shows, that there isn't any of that. It's any effects are all practical. And at the end you get the twist where it turns out there was something on the wing, and
the camera pulls back and we see the engine housing is all ripped to pieces, don't we?
Yeah.
And Conrad, Shatner sells it to us, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Shatner, like, honestly, a lot of the episodes that we're watching have a lot of, like, sort of good single perform, you know, like one character who's the main focus of the show that puts in a really good performance, whether it's Agnes Moorehead in The Invaders or Burgess Meredith in Time Enough. I think with this one, it does give Shatner a really good chance to just kind of be, he's really stressed out, but he kind of like, he knows he's had a nervous breakdown or whatever. He knows that everyone's going to think that he's crazy and that what he's seeing is like, you know, is not what you'd expect to see. He knows that like he's seeing something that's, you know, beyond the pale, and everyone's going to think that he's crazy again and like take him back to the madhouse or whatever. And so he's trying, you know, there's some really great moments actually as an actor where he's like, you know, very concerned about this being, this like terrifying dude that's like, you know, standing on the wing of the plane, destroying it. But he knows that if he said like that, he knows that like he, that, like this is something he's seen before. This is something that's going to get him in trouble if he says, and he's got to like weigh those two possibilities and stuff. You know, he's sort of subtly like trying to get his wife's attention to get her to like look out the window to see it and stuff, without kind of just eventually, you know, screaming, there's a man on the wing of the plane, he's going to kill us all, you know. But like, you know, he doesn't start out there. It's like it's a pretty slow burn to kind of get to that part of the episode. I think it's a really neat way to do it. I would say also, I think like the Gremlin's pretty scary, I guess. Like, and you know, while it is, I mean, definitely just like a dude in a suit with like funny makeup and stuff like that. Like, you know, when Shatner, like, you know, when he's like suddenly like in the window, like with his face pressed up against it, like when Shatner looks back and stuff like that, I remember like watching this episode as a kid and be like, ah, like that's, it's stupid. It's pretty scary stuff. Even still, you know, it sticks with you still.
I think that moment of the Gremlin's face pressed up against the window when Shatner pulls back the curtain was voted like, you know, one of the scariest moments on television. In some poll for the, you know, the 20th century. It's a great moment. It looks really good. I mean, as you say, Giles, once it pulls back and you see the full suit on the wing of the plane, it's perhaps not so good. But that close-up is tremendous.
Yeah, no, that moment is great. And part of why that works so well is because, as Conrad's just explained, Shatner really sells this. He really sells the state he's in. You can see there are a couple of moments when you can see him, what he is portraying, this idea of a man struggling who wants to say, listen, I'm not mad, but, and he knows he can't say that because they'd immediately think, well, you're mad, aren't you? And when he realizes, for example, that the air stewardess and the captain are trying to placate him by saying, oh yes, we know about the Gremlin, you know, it's all right. And he realizes they're just placating them. He doesn't say anything, but he expresses that he knows that facially really, really well. So you're really buying this from him. So that, yeah, like, you know, when that scare happens, which is, I think, unusual in the Twilight Zone, pretty very unusual in the Twilight Zone, in that it's a jump scare, you know, which not used a lot in those days. I mean, well, barely at all. And before they became, you know, de rigueur in the late 70s.
The 1983 movie of The Twilight Zone by John Landis is probably more famous now for the off-screen terrible accident that killed people during the filming. Obviously, John Lithgow plays this part in the film, and that does allow at least for a happier memory, which is when Lithgow and William Shatner both appeared in Third Rock of the Sun. And there's a famous,
it's one of my favorite parts, actually. Yeah.
They meet at an airport, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. They both meet. Yeah, like, you know, William Shatner's like, whatever. They're I don't want to talk about the overall plot of Third Rock from the Sun, but they pick, like, the John Lithgow picks William Shatner up from the airport and is like, oh, how was your flight? like there was, it was so strange. There was a man on the wing of the plane, and Lithgow said the same thing happened to me.
Great stuff. And a great, as you say, Giles, a great sort of jump scare in Twilight Zone, which is unusual. You mentioned also there were sequels, or rather there was remakes and various attempts. Jordan Peele has done the most recent one, I believe. None of them have sort of really captured the power of the originals. You know, those black and white originals are fantastic, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, this, because they've tried repeatedly, because they know the value of the franchise, that people, because it was so popular, and there's been repeated attempts to do it, and yet none have quite managed it. Managed to pull it off, and so that I think it's sort of an intangible as to why, to an extent, but part of it I think is to do with the time, the look, the fact it was the late 50s, early 60s, the way it was made. Rod Serling, obviously a huge part of that, and it's hard. It seems to have been impossible to re-bottle that magic. Even given that the formula for it is known. I mean, it's not you go back, if you watch five seasons of this and your job is in writing TV, I figure you could sit down and say, okay, well, I'm pretty sure we can nail this. You know, how do we do it? And yet recreating it successfully has eluded everyone else. I mean, the Jordan Peele one, it was pretty good. I quite liked it. I enjoyed it, but it didn't get renewed. I mean, I think those episodes were about an hour long, and you know, that would appear to be what the audience wants. That's what how long they want their dramas to be these days. But one of the things that I think the Twilight Zone did so brilliantly was to do beginning, middle, and end plus twist in what was effectively about 26 minutes. I think once you put the cigarette adverts in and all over the place. So it's definitely. I mean, the 80s series, which I've watched a few of, not an enormous amount because I don't hold it in the same affection. They did some good episodes. They really did some good. There were some pretty good ones. But I wouldn't, for example, sit down and say I'm going to watch a box set of the 80s Twilight Zone. And also, in the same way that I can't imagine any other series, for example, having the cultural impact that Conrad's just described, where you've got two enormously well-known actors in a third TV show, a completely separate TV show, referencing a TV show they made in 1964, I think it was, and that pop culture reference that they're referencing is well-known enough for everyone to get it.
We haven't really mentioned also, of course, there's the theme music, which has become one of those themes that is just synonymous with a certain vibe and feel, that when you hear the music, you know where you are in a way. You feel transported into the Twilight Zone. That's terrific. And Conrad, I just brought this up briefly in our notes. The twist ending in literature, I think not so well known on this side of the Atlantic, but in America, of course, you've got O. Henry. And the O. Henry stories, that's a famous, he was a famous sort of like exponent of this idea, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think like definitely, you know, like it's a little, I don't know if I'd like, if I talk to like the kids who I work with, if they'd know O. Henry off the top of their heads, I guess. But like, it's a very key part of like, it's in the bedrock there. I think the most famous one probably is The Gift to the Magi, it's called, which is sort of a classic one where like there's a young man with a very nice watch and a young woman with lovely hair, and they both love each other. And so for Christmas, she cuts off her hair to buy him a band for his watch, and he sells his watch to buy her combs for her hair and that sort of thing, you know. And that's very much that's very classic, like American kind of story, I guess, or like story that we think about a lot. But I mean, you know, the twist is like, I think humans love twists generally. We sort of, you know, that sort of like breaking of expectations and stuff like that, I think really, really speaks to us generally, not to get too big about it. I mean, you know, you think about something even just like, I don't know, like Oedipus or something. Again, not to get too heady, but that's very much a twist story where it's like, oh, someone's, you know, and I guess it's a little bit more dramatic irony, but it is still like, you know, someone's killed their dad and married their mom. Oh no, it's me. Like that sort of thing, you know, or like Edgar Allan Poe too, like, you know, stuff like, I think it's the cask of Amontillado or whatever, where the guy gets bricked up in like the basement and the kind of stuff. Like it's sort of these sorts of like turnips or like, you know, just sort of like going against what you expect to happen to be like you know, telling a story where you think it's going to be thing one or thing two, but it turns out to be, you know, a third thing you didn't see coming, I think is something that we all, you know, we like generally as people, and you see a ton of, and it does make the stories fun. And that's sort of like the M. Night Shyamalan, what a twist sort of thing. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's something that is always something that is fun narratively.
Just on that subject, I think I would like to posit an idea here that two things. First of all, O. Henry, Conrad, is that what O. Henry candy bars were named after?
I think it's at least one of those things where it's like, here's a name people have heard. Like, let's do a thing like that. It's sort of like how I don't know if they have Babe Ruths or Baby Ruths in England. I forget if they do or not, where it's sort of like, listen, there's a baseballer. Like, his name is famous. We need a name for the candy bar. Let's just name it after this guy, whatever. Like, it's the Wild West out there, you know?
All right. So, well, anyway, when we're off air, you can explain why I can't get O. Henry bars in the States anymore.
You know, people don't like turn of the century literature, I guess. Like something.
I would just like to put forward the idea that Alice in Wonderland, which came out in 1865 by Lewis Carroll, is a early progenitor of the twist ending as well, obviously, in that the ending of Alice in Wonderland was, oh, turns out it was all a dream, which was used so extensively in the wake of that, that by the 1970s, obviously no one could end a story with it was all a dream because you would be laughed at. So my theory is that in the 70s and 80s, and you'll both recognise this, is that the it was all a dream ending was in the future shock world replaced by the, oh, turns out they're in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one that became then, like, just used and used and used and used and used. So that was I think the it was all a dream ending was taken over by the they're playing a video game thing. So which is, yeah, it just shows, as Conrad was saying, the idea of the twist ending doesn't really matter. We like it. Doesn't really matter what form it is, or indeed how old it is. You know, you can give each little twist another twist, and you've got a whole new lease of life.
Yeah, because I think generally also, like, especially in Future Shocks, like the it was just a dream ending usually has a secondary twist as well, where it's sort of like, I'm thinking of a specific one where, like, there's a story about a guy fighting an alien or something and it kills him, but then he wakes up and it was just a dream. And then he looks over and says, oh, hello, dear. And it turns out that his wife looks exactly like the crazy alien that he was fighting or something like that, you know?
Air horns.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's very, you know, it's playing with that format or something like that, you know, like, again, it's just, yeah, this, the pulling back to reveal the frame or something is always a good, you know, a good time for these kinds of stories, for sure.
Anybody who's been to the 2080 writer or artist talent search competitions at Thought Bubble in Harrogate here in the UK will know that Matt Smith, the current incumbent of the Rosette of Sirius, I think he's now said, no more, they're in virtual realities, please. That's like, he's been so well done. But on that subject, just to wrap us up, Giles, you've mentioned the purity of those original Twilight Zone episodes. It's done in 25 minutes. The Future Shock for 2000 AD is still a testing ground for new writers and artists to say, can you do this in three or four pages and give us a twist on the last page reveal? It's still got that sort of purity of the original episodes, hasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely has. And I think there's a thing here as well that we can... I know Future Shocks are filler to an extent, and I know why they were created, as Conrad mentioned earlier. You know, Tharg comes into the office on a Monday and it turns out they haven't sold two pages of ads and they need something to fill the hole. But what I will say is I think it's an immense it is one of the hardest writing tasks for comics, and which is why so many great writers honed their teeth on it, Alan Moore not least. And pulling one off well is really, really good. I also think part of the reason the Twilight Zone, for example, and those early Future Shocks were so impactful is that it depends how old you were, I think. You know, when I was 10, I wasn't finding Future Shocks sort of boring. I really liked them because I wasn't expecting any of the endings. You know, I was like, oh, turns out they were tiny aliens.
Amazing.
When are you going to melt down, etc. As we've discussed, the three of us, I thought the twist ending to Escape from New York was work of cinematic genius, and I will die on that hill to the end of this day. So that was one of the greatest twists of all time. So I think it's an enormously difficult task to pull it off, to do it well in four pages of comics, and these days to do it well and have an original idea. An extraordinary feat, and every now and then someone does it, and it really catches the attention when they do, and that is part of what I would say is part of what many parts of the legacy of the Twilight Zone.
I just want to say, yeah, definitely. I think that, like, you know, just because they're filler doesn't mean they have to be bad, you know? Like, there's definitely room for Future Shocks that are good and for future people who take time to write good Future Shocks and stuff. You know, I think it's easy to tar them with a brush of it's just filler, it's just secondary stuff. But I think that, you know, when there's craft, when they're well done, it makes them stand out, and that's really good.
Great stuff. Well, all power to Rod Serling and the original Twilight Zone. Let us know what your own particular favorite episodes from the original run were. And that has been our visit to the Twilight Zone. Let's just give links where people can find our work. At megacitybookclub.com, you will find links to my stuff and also to Conrad and Giles. But if for direct listeners, or let's give them directly to the listeners. Conrad, where can we find you?
Spacespinner2000.com. And just, you know, wherever you listen to this, you can find Space Spinner. We're back at it now, 1996. We're making our way through it. Oh, my gosh. I think when this comes out, we will either have just done or be about to do the debut of Sinister Dexter, just in terms of where we are in the Prague timeline. Just exciting stuff coming up in the history of 2000 AD as we get through it in Space Spinner 2000.
Great stuff. And Giles, I think last time we were talking, you had John Cusack'd your way into High Fidelity. Tell us about your own record label.
Yes, I had John Cusack my way. My record label is called INH Records. I run it in my spare time when I'm not writing about Formula One. It's terrifically exciting, and we are proceeding the pace. A month ago, we put out the new album by Bug Eye, which is called The Shape of Things. And yesterday, 2 days ago, we put out the new record by Gabby Garber, which is called Radical Love. You can buy all these records, and it'd be enormously grateful if you did, to support a tiny little independent label from INH Records on Bandcamp. So, and I can guarantee to you they are all superb records from start to finish, rather like the very best episodes of The Twilight Zone.
Fantastic. Look in the show notes for links to inhrecords.com and to the Bandcamp site. And yeah, as you say, support independent music, support independent musicians, and support a little record label.
Absolutely.
And if you have a film or a television show that you can link to British comics, if no one else can help you, and if you can find us in or out of the Twilight Zone, then maybe you too can join the film club. Email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
I'm Giles.
And we have been
Bigger City Film Club.
Do, 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 do. Yeah.